Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. British election returns can land in the U.S. like weather forecasts. Margaret Thatcher in 1979 cued Ronald Reagan in 1980. Bush the First and John Major were a match pair of caretakers for the 90s. Then Bill Clinton here and Tony Blair over there steered back toward a new middle or muddle. The Brexit rebellion in 2016 was a foretaste of Donald Trump and America First. And now, on the eve of our 2020 campaign, comes a conservative landslide in the UK and a rich, rebel, right-wing, so-called populist leading from London with a short list of slogans. It looks and sounds familiar. Boris Johnson is their Trump. The feckless Labour socialist Jeremy Corbyn is their Bernie Sanders. Clamorous conservatism up, neo-socialism cooked. But does the quick impression survive inspection? David Runciman is our guest this hour on the winter wind blowing out of British politics. But first, our producer, Connor Gillies, took a rough sample of North London opinion on sidewalks in the borough of Haringey between Hampstead Heath and Tottenham.
There was a referendum. It was leave or not leave. End of story. Doesn't worry about the lies. The lies don't matter. Leave or not leave. Leave won. The ones that didn't want to leave couldn't admit it, couldn't accept it, and basically said, well, if we get into power, we're going to have another referendum. So how many more referendums?
I think governments or oppositions or whatever should not forget the lower class, because that's where the majority of the votes come from. Because I think with Labour, they were so sure of their votes, but they didn't go back, they didn't knock on those doors, they didn't go and actually sit and listen to the people, they didn't go to the pubs, because that's where all the politics happens. I think the fact is that Labour, they've been in opposition for 9 years. And come election time, they were so much on the fence and they seemed very undecided. And some of the things they were promising were quite wishy-washy. And I really hope that they take this time to reflect, to get young blood into the party, to go back and try and understand what are the real issues affecting people. So yeah, I think for now people are happy that Conservatives are in, because obviously there's a strong voice there. We have people who we feel if we sent them out on the international stage they can actually represent us. Whereas Labour, we miss them. We wish they'd come back. This was an easy race they could have won, but they didn't do it. So I think everyone's just rolling with the punches right now.
The biggest lesson for Labour would be we need to remember that there was an old song saying you gotta give people what they want.
I think our electoral system is completely defective and that the result was very bad, but it would have been equally bad if the Labour Party had won. The only possible improvement would be if the Parliament continued to be stuck and the people of this country finally understood that our problems are all of our own making and have got nothing to do with the European Union.
David Runciman is a scholar at Cambridge University, a pundit at the London Review of Books, and a podcaster at the site called Talking Politics. Speak to the dread, I asked David Runciman, that Americans were watching our own 2020 race being decided on his election night.
Okay, so let's work it backwards. The left is cooked. That might be the harder one to talk you out of, but I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is Bernie Sanders. And the thing that people probably should remember about Jeremy Corbyn, who don't know the full story, is he came very close to being prime minister 2 years ago.
Right.
In 2017 against Theresa May. He was probably within, if they'd been distributed in different seats, about 10,000 votes of becoming prime minister, which means anyone who concludes he is completely unelectable has got it wrong. You know, it really depends on context. But second time round, he was unelectable. And it was partly because people knew him better. The first time round, he had the advantage that people could project onto him what they wanted. Didn't work this time. But he's not Bernie Sanders. He has a completely different kind of baggage, very UK-related. What people seem to have decided now, a few days on, is that the difference between the last British election and this one is what happened about 18 months ago in this country, the moment when Jeremy Corbyn's poll ratings went into rapid decline and never recovered, which was the poisonings in a small English town called Salisbury, when it turned out that Putin's thugs had tried to kill Russian emigres and indeed a British citizen died. And Corbyn took not the Russian side, but he was pretty equivocal. And these things really matter. And all the evidence, anecdotal and other evidence since, is that for his core constituency, that seemed like a fundamentally unpatriotic act. Now, I don't think there is an equivalent of that in your case. I mean, Bernie's got a long history too, but I don't think anything that I'm aware of has happened in the last year or 18 months that could be pinned on him in the way that this did.
The heart attack is not an equivalent. At the same time, people thought, people thought that Bernie in 16 would have beaten Donald Trump, that Hillary was a much more defeatable candidate. But also there's a funny difference. Corbyn, his great enemy in life is the sort of imperial hangover and the imperial imagination in England. Bernie keeps it simple. It's just billionaires.
I mean, to be blunt, Corbyn's great enemy in life is the United States. It's also the British Empire. So he also has a long history with the IRA and Irish republicanism. There isn't a Bernie equivalent for that either. But it absolutely is with Corbyn that over time people came to feel that his primary motivation in politics was actually a position on international politics. So some people don't care, and the people who do care felt like he was on the wrong side. Corbyn's sidekick, a man called John McDonnell, who would have been his finance minister, much, much more focused on the economy, in some ways closer to Bernie Sanders. But of course, he wasn't the candidate to be prime minister. And Boris isn't Trump either, just to get to the other one.
Boris is not Trump. But spell that out. What is the appeal of Boris Johnson? From here, he looks like a, I don't know, some sort of Pac-Man, little bug on your screen that's just bouncing all around, losing everything until he won the big one. His brother said, I'm out of here. Who is he?
He does have some features in common with Trump. And I think, to put the positive gloss on it, the relentless energy, the stamina, the ability to keep going in the face of things that would silence any other politician. And it's got a kind of shamelessness to it as well. He was relentless in the way that, you know, Trump on the stump, Boris on the stump, not so dissimilar. But I think Boris is still a much more conventional politician. I mean, first of all, he is a politician. I mean, he's a career politician. And he's a career winner. You know, for me, the salient fact about Donald Trump is he won the presidency the first time he ever stood for election for anything. Boris Johnson has been winning consistently throughout his career. He won the Mayor of London election when no one thought he could. He won the leadership of the Conservative Party. He's won this general election. And he won the Brexit referendum too. Boris and Trump are both unsinkable, but Boris is a serial winner. He wins all the elections he fights. Trump's only won one. He may win another one. Trump effectively, I think, mounted a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. Boris is he's a conservative. He's a recognizable kind of conservative. He's slightly more shameless. And certainly before this election as prime minister, he took the kind of chances most conservatives are pretty uncomfortable with, including alienating the Queen, which is not something conservatives tend to enjoy doing. But he absolutely, you know, I've been aware of him in politics for 20 years, and you've never felt, as I do with Trump looking from the outside, that this guy is coming completely from the outside. And so there is an open question, I think, with Boris. When Trump became president, people who thought, well, now he's going to become some kind of conventional politician were naive, to put it mildly. But with Boris, it's still an open question. People still genuinely don't know. So, yeah, he's been bouncing around like a blue bottle winning this election. But now he's prime minister. If it's anything like as he was as mayor of London, he will settle down. It won't be ratcheted up necessarily in the way that the Trump presidency has been. So then they're not the same. And I think the big difference is just that Boris has a politician's instincts, a politician's career. And for that reason, potentially, he's going to have a politician's sense of what he needs to do to keep going.
He's also committed to expanding health service, which is a curious tick. Come back to the left side, though, in the sense that the Corbyn project and maybe the Sanders project is over, that the left has been smoking something about this appetite for an enthusiastically renewed social democracy. Has that been shaken or not?
So this is the big question, I think. And for me, the big takeaway from our election, which might have relevance for yours, is Corbyn did put on votes in certain places, the Labour Party project with its big expansion of the state, higher taxes, and in some ways punitive taxes on the rich, and really ambitious projects to nationalise, to make things available for free, including broadband. It does have an appeal, no question, and, and the places where it has an appeal, they did put on votes in London. They did very well. They did well in university towns. But traditionally, I think the left's project in an election is to feel, well, we have more people on our side and we've got to mobilise them. If we can get them out, we will win. We have the numbers, but our people often either don't vote or aren't engaged in politics and so on. It's a massive mobilisation effort. And this election, there was a massive mobilisation effort. The Corbyn Project is that, particularly among young people. And it was relatively successful in some respects. They did get their vote out, but they do not have the numbers anymore. The core vote is not the working class. The working class, many of them have gone to the Conservatives. Their core vote is young people and university graduates. And I've been saying this for a while. I think it's the big lesson of politics the last 10 years, which is if your coalition is young people and university graduates, you will lose because there aren't enough. And all the evidence from this election, it's really striking, the most striking election of all in recent times. The age differential, people over the age of 65 were voting for Conservatives in massive numbers. People under the age of 30 were voting Labour in massive numbers, overwhelming. But there are more of the old people than the young people.
You were quoted to that effect in The New Yorker, a wonderful sentence. You said, the central demographic fact of Western democracy is that there are not enough young people.
Well, not enough young people for this project, because this is absolutely a young person's project. It's targeting young people. The mobilization is primarily of young people. There's a number which is called the age at which people go conservative. It's like the point at which, in the demographic, the conservatives get more votes than Labour. At the last election, it had gone up to the mid-40s. It's come back down to the late 30s. But the trouble is, even when it's at the mid-40s, it's close, as it was last time. But people over the age of 45 still outnumber people under the age of 45 in our, you know, with our demographics. Yours is a slightly younger country than ours, and we are still younger than places like Greece and Italy and Spain, where, you know, the median age is pushing 50. But these are really raw facts for any project which is a mobilization of young people. And the same thing applies for college or university education, which is the core demographic, again, of these. And I think it's true with Sanders's support. That's an essential part of it. And though we are aware that many, many more people go to college than used to, we still live in societies where the majority haven't and didn't.
David Runciman is reading the British tea leaves for us. Coming up, how Brexit took over the conversation and drove the vote over there. This is Open Source. We're reading British politics for a distant early warning of our own. Brexit is the big difference between European politics and ours these days. I wondered to David Runciman whether Donald Trump's wall on the border with Mexico is metaphorically our version of turning our backs on neighbors and the world. But I said people are still trying to figure out how Brexit came to drive the British election and to turn great swaths of the map of England from Labour red to Tory blue.
So Brexit drove the election in part because it had reached a point a couple of months ago in our parliament where our politics was frozen. It was genuinely stuck. It's one of those rare occasions where there are days where you thought there is no way forward, there is no way back, there is no way sideways. People are just shouting at each other day after day. And this election was essentially to break the deadlock, and my God, it has. You know, if anything has broken the deadlock, it's broken it wide open. It's going to happen. There's no question about it now. And it's going to get done. The first phase of it is going to get done. Maybe the final phase is still up in the air, but we will be leaving the European Union. The other thing that we discovered in this election is that the country is divided, and in polling, when people asked, we're still roughly a 50-50 country, do you want this thing to happen or not? If the question is, other things being equal, do you want it to happen? But the party that campaigned explicitly on what's called here revoke, which is overturning the result of the referendum, that's the Liberal Democratic Party. And they thought, like, if nearly half the people don't want it to happen, they're going to vote for a party that says explicitly, we will stop it. And they did really badly. And it does seem like, even for the people who would prefer Brexit not to happen, there was a recognition that having had a referendum, it's a really dangerous thing not to honour the result. And I think we discovered that too this week, that it's not clear there is a majority for Brexit, but there is a majority for not ignoring the referendum.
That's so interesting, and it rhymes somehow with the feeling about impeachment in this country. The basic rule is you get a four-year term, even if you screw up, yeah. And people have screwed up in all sorts of different ways.
Our democracies are pretty fractious and pretty, at times, unpleasant at the moment, but you are playing with fire as soon as you actually effectively overturn the primary electoral means of achieving change.
Exactly.
And though we don't do referendums very often, the referendum was sold to people as something that would be enacted. So not to do it is potentially more dangerous than all the other stuff that we're doing.
You still wonder why it couldn't have been reconsidered or rewritten or tempered. And all the more interesting because it broke along the lines of the London elite against Middle England, the non-prospering older folk. Was it really a division over Brexit, or did it become the occasion for drawing a fight between those two rising and declining pieces of your country?
I mean, I think there was a substantive division on the question itself. People didn't just see the European Union as a kind of proxy for their dissatisfaction with everything. There has for a long time in the UK been a rumbling feeling that we're not like the rest of Europe, and to be, in some areas of our lives, governed by people who people in Britain still think of as coming from a different tradition is a problem. But that got swept up, as you say, with this much wider question. And in this election that we've just had, in our general election, where the Conservatives captured these constituencies that were very pro-Brexit but traditionally voted Labour, it wasn't actually so much Middle England, it was the North of England. That's what people have been most struck by. Parts of the North of England that have voted Labour for 100 years, unbroken, on election night. The first seat the Conservatives won, they won a seat that Labour had held for nearly 100 years. That is a lot of elections. I don't know how many we've had in 100 years, but it's, you know, it's what, 25 something? And that's right in the north, just beneath Scotland. And that part of the country, which recently, even for Tony Blair, so Tony Blair's old seat went Conservative.
Wow.
When Tony Blair held that seat, he had an impregnable majority, untouchable. It's inconceivable. Again, it's in the northeast of England. So Middle England is complicated, and the middle, I mean, geographically, is a mix. You know, it's nearer London and all that. The gap between the south and the north now is huge. And this is the most striking thing in this election. The north was pro-Brexit, and now the north is Boris Johnson's heartland.
Mm.
You know, think about that.
Well, it's a phenomenon that we called Reagan Democrats. Older union workers, shall we say middle class, middle mood Democrats who in 1980 went the other way.
Yeah.
Explain it in English terms. What happened between the left and the Labour Party?
What, that meant that they lost these seats?
There's an American parallel there, and not only the Reagan Democrats, but even today, Democrats who voted Trump and elite university towns and big rich centers that vote substantially blue, Democratic. This is a switch in our country and yours.
And the break between them, I mean, you have the equivalent too. We had Blair, you had Clinton. So
you
know, we had the Labour politician, you had the Democratic politician who got back to the middle and, you know, depending on how you want to put it, kind of triangulated their way into a new coalition, which drew many of these people back. And another very notable feature of our recent election, someone leaked one of the campaigning memos given to these young campaigners who were going out trying to get out the vote for Corbyn, telling them, you know, if you meet one of the working class voters that used to be Labour and they want to shut the door in your face, keep talking and get a conversation going and start the conversation by ripping Tony Blair. That's what it said. Take on Blair first.
Right.
Remind these people that we are no longer the party of Tony Blair. Huge mistake. Blair is loathed and reviled by Corbyn supporters because of the Iraq war.
Exactly.
But for the people that they lost, that's not the issue anymore. And though Blair is a very unpopular figure in this country because people have long memories and that war remains profoundly unpopular and him siding with George W. Bush is for many people in the Labour movement the ultimate betrayal, focusing on that because that's what motivates some of the core Corbyn supporters was to ignore what the people who could and who have switched traditional Labour voters back to the Conservatives if they, or for the first time to the Conservatives, that's not the issue for them. The issue for them are core questions of, as they saw it, patriotism. So you can lay into Blair for his terrible war, but Blair didn't take the side of Putin. You know, it's not that. And then this is about economics, and it's about people's sense of, you know, where they belong, and it's about their sense of identity. And that battle with Blair is too long ago. I mean, Clinton, I don't think, plays the same role, but, you know, I know he and his wife, profoundly and deeply unpopular, almost despised more by left Democrats than Republicans.
Absolutely. I mean, Trump got a foothold in the race to begin with by absolutely tearing Jeb Bush apart for the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
The mystery was why the Democrats persisted with a Hillary campaign that was almost equally tainted by that war. David Runciman, I'm fascinated by all the things you've learned about the country, your country, in this campaign, including the age and educational divide, but particularly this word nationalism. It's a subtle question here and everywhere. The nationalism that surfaced in England this year seems ambiguous. It's nostalgia in Middle England for its old go-it-alone, which was an imperial role. At the same time, it's a retreat from empire.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the UK, nationalism is a really complicated thing, partly, as you said, because Scottish nationalism, very, very different. People associate nationalism with anti-immigrant sentiment. The Scottish National Party, that want independence for Scotland, are the most pro-immigration party in the UK. They want to open Scotland up. Mm. They are very much seeing themselves as part of Europe. And they did very, very well in this election. You know, that movement has still got a lot of life in it. It's set against what people think of as a kind of English nationalism that doesn't have a very clear voice. But you're right, it does have this kind of two-faced element to it. There's a nostalgia for when, I think necessarily that we had an empire, but that we had a kind of, in the minds of many people, a sort of self-sufficiency, and being as part of the EU was a betrayal of that.
Hmm.
But it also, you know, the most pejorative word that you can use in this context is a kind of nativism, which is, you know, people who come from a place are suspicious of people who don't have those kind of roots. There's a bit of that in there too. But the other word I would include here, which I think was really important in this election, was patriotism, which is different. And it was the word that's most often used by the people who turned against Corbyn and ended up backing Johnson. For better or for worse, they thought it was an issue of patriotism. It was about whether you were willing to defend your country against people who want to subvert it or not. You know, this suspicion of Corbyn that he was willing to side with the enemies of Britain or even of the West. And these things are all mixed up. Patriotism, nationalism, nativism. And nationalism is probably the muddiest of them all, because as a state, the United Kingdom is not a single nation. There's Wales as well. The Conservatives did very well in Wales, even though Wales also has a party of national independence that also did well. You know, it's a messy situation. And we are not a presidential system. We're a parliamentary system. So our parliament, which is sovereign, is this kind of mosaic of all of these nationalisms. And over the next 5 years, we'll see them. And they'll be competing with the internationalists too. And there are many of those. So Johnson has, you know, he's got to negotiate that space. And I think, again, it would be a mistake just to think of him as a Little England nationalist. Hmm. But some of that sentiment did get him elected.
What's the mirror impression you're seeing in our country, where Trump talks about making America great again, but also detaching himself from NATO, from Europe, from old alliances, and pulling back in a certain way?
So we're not a superpower. We're an island. We don't have a land border. Well, our land border is with Scotland and Wales. So, you know, if Scotland becomes independent, that'll be a very complicated question, what that border looks like. The Brexit issue turned on this incredibly difficult question of the border in Ireland. But it doesn't. None of that has the raw, potentially mobilizing power of your southern border in politics and the rhetoric around that. So for us, in some ways, some of the stakes aren't quite as high. Johnson is not going to be the kind of politician who wants to withdraw from NATO. He is going to, I think, in many ways in international politics, be relatively conventional. The strongest signal that you're getting from Johnson that he's not an internationalist is he's told his MPs they're not allowed to go to Davos. because he thinks his new constituents in the north of England don't want to see their representatives drinking champagne with billionaires and talking about globalism. So there's a little bit, you know, but to be an anti-Davos politician is not the same as being a build-that-wall politician. And I don't think people should jump from the first to assume that Johnson is close to the second.
Interesting.
Not yet. But of course, he's also going to have to forge a relationship with Donald Trump. And everyone who's seen people trying to forge, look at Macron, seen people trying to forge a relationship with Donald Trump knows that you're playing with fire there too.
It makes me wonder, is Donald Trump's wall a metaphor for Brexit or vice versa?
Yeah, and I don't think it works, partly because it looks like we're ending up in the UK context with this mysterious thing called a border in the Irish Sea, which, whatever else it is, can't be a wall. It's a kind of virtual thing. Hmm. It's a customs issue. It's not a migration issue. What it probably means for the UK is that Northern Ireland may progressively become more and more detached from the rest of the UK, and we may be slowly on the road to a united Ireland. And that would be a huge shift in UK politics. And that it might begin under a Conservative politician would be a remarkable thing. But that's a very complex issue with hundreds of years of history behind it. And there's nothing as simple or simplistic as the idea of a wall there to capture what's going on. For many people, I mean, the commonest thing you heard in the run-up to this election about the Irish question is that it's too complicated. And it may be that a genuine solution to the question of what happens on the southern border of the United States, a serious solution, would be too complicated, but the politics of it is not complicated. It's too simple. We haven't got anything like that.
Map all that onto the idea we hear that your country wants to be more English and less British, or that that's part of the result.
Yeah, it's definitely true that, say, when Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair were winning their big election victories, there was a sense that they were doing well, or at least that they had a body of support that cut across the United Kingdom, and that Scotland wasn't entirely another country, though under Margaret Thatcher it was very progressively less and less happy to be governed by her and from London. But now Scotland really is another country. It returned almost entirely Scottish National Party MPs. And therefore England feels more like a separate country. So I think the difference is, in the past, people in England did not feel that separation because they didn't see it so visibly. It's much, much clearer now. And there has been a gradual build-up. It's not a kind of rising tide, but a kind of bubbling resentment on the part of some English voters, channeled through politicians, that Scotland gets a free ride. The English subsidise the Scots. And there, you know, you can argue the figures either way. But the fact that that sentiment is out there is evidence of a kind of soft English nationalism. But it's not raw. It's not like nationalisms that you see in other places. It's not even like, you know, Modi in Indian nationalism. It's not like the far right in Germany at the moment. And that idea of Englishness, it rarely gets articulated. You don't get many politicians talking about what it means to be English. It tends to come out more regionally than that. So rather than people saying, I speak for England, what happened to England? They speak for the forgotten bits of England, the bits that have been left behind. I still think English nationalism is a weaker force than nationalism elsewhere.
It reminds me somehow, and we've got to talk about the late, great Orwell. I mean, he was a student of Little England, had great reservations about Imperial England. But more particularly, this election reminded me of The Road to Wigan Pier, which was his wonderful work from the mid-1930s, in which he realized it started when he said, the chattering class in London has the foggiest idea what's up in the working class. And he became a coal miner for months and lived like a coal miner to get the feel of it. We need Orwell again. There's such a gap between the working reality and the thinking class. What have we got to learn anew from Orwell?
So I think definitely in this election, for some politicians, there was some of that feeling that even in their own constituencies that they represent, but more, I think, politicians who don't normally travel to those parts of the country but were traveling to campaign, that they had lost touch, that they were surprised. Many politicians were surprised by what they were finding, by what was animating voters. And it cuts across both parties. The Conservatives seem to have been more attuned to the gap than Labour were, and Labour has become very much a London party. So that is going on. And I think it does have a lot to do with the professionalisation of politics, the fact that politicians whatever their party, even those politicians on the far left tend to come from not necessarily a particular class in the old-fashioned sense, but what the new class, which is the kind of graduate, college, university-educated, metropolitan class. And there whole parts of the country, it's changed a bit in this election because quite a few of the new MPs actually are from more traditional backgrounds. But Parliament is still pretty unrepresentative of the country that it governs because if you just take the most basic fact, almost everyone there went to university and the large majority of the people who live in the United Kingdom didn't. And if going to university is now one of the things that creates a political outlook, there is a huge gulf there. That's what's so great about elections. I mean, elections are this wonderful exercise in discovering what country you live in. Mm. So a lot of people were amazed by the Brexit referendum to discover the country we lived in. It was like a veil had been drawn back and we could see it. And this election's had some of that effect too. And smart politicians, shrewd politicians, open-minded politicians adapt. It's a big question for the Labour Party whether it will, the veil having been drawn back, whether it will look hard at what we can now see and learn from it, or whether it will continue down the same path. And Tony Blair, on the morning that we're recording this conversation, told the Labour Party that if it continues down that same path, it will cease to exist. We still have a system where it's first past the post. There are really only two parties. It's really hard to kill one of them. But we may see an experiment in that over the next 5 years.
David Runciman teaches politics at Cambridge, and he writes regularly in the London Review of Books. His podcast is called Talking Politics, and he's not finished with us. Coming up, the English political writer now living in the States, Libby Watson, joins us. The immortal George Orwell, alas, does not. This is Open Source. Libby Watson writes in The New Republic about U.S. politics from a leftish English perspective. She spoke to us this week about the gap growing here and there between working class voters and the parties they used to vote for.
Since Trump's election, there have been countless articles about how to win back the working class, and often specifically how to win back the white working class. You know, it seems to be kind of considered this fundamental thing that Democrats absolutely must do is win back the white working class. And depending on your politics, the things that are suggested to do that vary. When left-wingers talk about winning back the white working class, they might talk about economic issues. And when conservatives talk about winning back the white working class, they tend to talk about how Democrats are too woke, or how Democrats, you know, don't recognize the kind of culture war aspects or whatever. And, you know, now in Britain, this was very much a Brexit election. And I know that, you know, one of the analyses that has been put forward, especially by more left-wing British people, is that simply Jeremy Corbyn was in a very tight spot here on Brexit. You know, he had to kind of straddle the line between not alienating the Remain support that the big chunk of Labour voters that were Remain supporters, while also balancing the fact that, you know, many of the areas that Labour had been traditionally strong voted Leave, you know, like those sort of former mining towns in the northeast and places like that. I saw some data the other day that of people who voted Leave in 2016 and also voted for Labour in the 2017 elections, only 52% of those people voted Labour again this time. So a lot of those people that had voted Labour previously, when Jeremy Corbyn was still leader, abandoned the party. Boris Johnson did a very good job, and understandably so, given the politics of making this, you know, the Brexit election, you know, going around Britain saying, we're going to get Brexit done. He even is at a campaign event, drove through a brick wall that said gridlock on a forklift truck that was marked get Brexit done. So that was really his whole thing. You know, I think a lot of voters responded to that. So, you know, I think there is this temptation to draw this sort of one-to-one comparison between left-wing policies, left-wing leaders, it didn't work. But in many of Jeremy Corbyn's policies, like even, you know, nationalization of certain industries, you know, those things polled well. They did well in the polls, just as in America, things like Green New Deal and universal healthcare, those things do poll well. The question is translating that into election victories when you have actually a specific candidate.
Libby, I think David Runciman is making the point, and others have observed, that Jeremy Corbyn may have got a little too comfy with the university class rather than the working class. Bernie, in fact, may be very well connected with workers already, but how would you instruct him?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. These Remain voters, you know, the kind of, you know, Guardian reading, London living, upper crust types, yeah, they, you know, generally did remain with Labour. You know, that obviously the question is what to do about everybody else. In terms of advice for Bernie, I mean, Bernie's whole thing, this, you know, 2016 and this time, the argument for him has been that he can bring in voters that have not been engaged in politics in the past few elections. You know, part of the reason that Hillary lost in 2016, it wasn't just, you know, obviously she won the popular vote, but, you know, losing the black vote in places like, you know, Wisconsin, you know, losing areas that had previously been held. And that wasn't because they were voting for Trump. It was because of turnout. So, you know, about turning out voters, like Labour maybe just didn't, you know, did a great job. But, you know, when I was looking at, you know, the tweets on election day from Labour campaigners, they had tons and tons of canvassers in London, in Putney, in places like that. But less, you know, organizing, you know, maybe less organizing and support in the places they really needed to be, which was like Sunderland and the Northeast. If your electoral strategy hinges on bringing in people that are not traditionally, you know, that engaged in politics or, you know, don't necessarily vote every time, you've really got to go to them. And, you know, I do think that that is something that Bernie's campaign has demonstrated it's very strong at.
Speaking of tweets, Libby, one of the lessons out of England surely is that Twitter world is not political reality. It's razor sharp, but it's not where the votes are. How do political junkies correct for the fact that Twitter is not the real world?
Well, it depends on what you mean by correct. I mean, if you're talking about that,
don't believe that the swiftest, fastest, newest remark gives you any idea of where the votes are going.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think that's true. I think we all kind of fall prey to that kind of bias of, you know, because I've seen it on Twitter, then it's therefore relevant to the election or whatever. It doesn't really, you know, I think the media would frankly be a little better if it were listening to some of the more lefty voices on Twitter. The media, I think, is broadly sort of centrist in its ideological bent, and it sees its particular kind of objectivity as self-explanatory. As a lefty person, I think it's great that there are people pushing back on that from the left on Twitter. That's not to say that Twitter is a good website. It's a very bad place. We should spend less time on it.
Bernie's trigger is billionaires. Corbyn's trigger is empire, including the American empire. Are you satisfied that Bernie has the emphasis right?
Politics are much further to the left in Britain in general than they are here. And Corbyn was further to the left on foreign policy. In terms of, you know, his views on, like you say, empire and everything, I don't really think that was a massively defining issue this election. The question that keeps getting asked of him over and over again is whether he would do a first nuclear strike. You know, that was asked of him in 2017. It was asked this time. This wasn't a foreign policy election. And frankly, 2020 is not going to be a foreign policy election in the US either. It's not going to, you know, the Washington Post Afghan papers just came out, you know, this week, last week, and no one is talking about them. You know, we can't get people to talk about foreign policy. It's going to be, you know, a domestic policy election.
Libby Watson, write Bernie a quick memo. Here's what you got to learn from England.
Be aware of the media. You know, Jeremy Corbyn, from the moment he was elected in 2015, just story after story about, frankly, just completely insane things. Like, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't sing the national anthem. Jeremy Corbyn didn't kneel for the Queen. It was one story. It was Jeremy Corbyn stole some sandwiches that were meant for veterans. You know, that was a real story that came out in The Sun in 2015. If Bernie wins the nomination, the media is going to be extremely surprised and not know what to do. And I think they got to watch out for the stuff that happened to Corbyn in the aftermath, because they don't know what to do when someone who is genuinely left-wing gets elected.
Libby Watson, thank you. And if Bernie gets elected, he'll thank you.
I think that's probably true.
David Runciman remarked earlier that elections are this wonderful exercise in discovering what country you live in. George Orwell's Inventory of Englishness at the start of World War II is still a perfect model, a little book called The Lion and the Unicorn, written in 1940 about the diversity of his country. The chaos, he said, the solid breakfasts and gloomy Sundays, smoky towns and winding roads, green fields and red pillar boxes, a flavor of its own. So I was asking David Runciman about the softer symptoms of 2019 in the UK. What would Orwell be noticing about the effects of social media, of culture wars, political correctness, workers' pubs, and universities? Also, the rumors and instances of outbreaks of white supremacy, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. What would Orwell or Runciman be learning in the conversational interactions around this election?
Well, I think we learned similar things that you've been learning. I think all democracy has been learning for a while, which is that the tribes aren't really speaking to each other anymore. So there was a heightened version of this election took place on social media. The election on social media was much more raw and fraught than what people said they were experiencing in face-to-face conversations. So people who were going out and knocking on people's doors were not getting the kind of raw, sustained anger and vitriol that you get online. They were getting a certain amount of contempt and disdain and frustration from voters. But that heightened online version, each side calling the other side out the whole time and effectively trying to delegitimize the other side. That's not the, I think, most people's experience of how voters think and behave in what you might call their everyday lives. But everyone is on social media. The Conservative Party successfully campaigned using Facebook, communicating with these older voters. It's not like younger voters get their news online and older voters get their news in other ways. We're all part of this. But it still feels like a lot of people have said one lesson of this election is that Twitter is not the real world. And you know, Labour probably won the election on Twitter, but they lost it in the real world.
That's a warning to us too.
The anti-Semitism and the Islamophobia, I mean, these things are real and they really matter. And they really matter, obviously, to this kind of online conversation, the anger there. Hmm. It's not clear that they matter so much to the large number of voters, particularly the ones who change sides. Some people, traditional Labour voters, said that anti-Semitism was an issue for us and they didn't trust Corbyn as a result. And this is real, but I mean, these things have always been real. I mean, it's, you know, when Orwell was writing, it's not like he wasn't aware that he was writing about a profoundly anti-Semitic society, Britain, even though it was also in the middle of a war against the most anti-Semitic society the world's ever seen. So it's all relative too. What we've learned about ourselves is, in some ways, we're not as different as we might have been 10 years ago, 20 years ago. We haven't been socially transformed by social media. We're not a completely different society, even if we communicate in different ways. For me, the big takeaway from our election is what an old-fashioned election it actually felt like. And Boris Johnson campaigned like he would have campaigned 40 years ago.
What does that mean, though?
Being photographed in butcher's shops and in hospitals and, you know, trying to smile at children.
Kissing babies, in fact, right?
Kissing babies. The messaging was very simple. It was very straightforward. Get Brexit done. I mean, you don't need Twitter to communicate the message, get Brexit done. You just need to keep saying it and, you know, putting it on the side of leaflets, on the side of, not in this case, buses, but anything you could find. You know, it felt like one of those elections where people who think that it's all changed were wrong and people who think that social media has changed everything was wrong. And we're probably more of a country that Orwell would recognize than we realized. We are still in some ways the same. We're not the same Britain, because Britain and the UK may be breaking up, but we are the same England in many ways. I think Orwell would absolutely recognize some of the dynamics in this election, even if he would be probably quite surprised to find himself encountering Twitter.
Yeah, I always go back to that Orwell sentence saying that England is a family ruled by the wrong members of it.
And he would also, the thing that wouldn't be unfamiliar to him at all is Boris Johnson is a old Etonian toff, as we would call him. He comes from a pretty narrow and elite part of the class structure. Right. The Conservative Party, though, it has, particularly this election, has got quite a lot of new kinds of people in it and new kinds of, not just supporters, but MPs. But the elite is still a very old-fashioned elite, narrow set of schools, set of universities, set of connections. We still feel like that kind of society too. You know, the Corbyn project was designed to blow that wide open, and it hasn't.
Right.
And again, I think Orwell would feel that people who think that, you know, the 21st century is a complete transformation would only have to look at this election to see that some of the connections at the top among the powerful are entirely familiar would be for someone who was alive 100 years ago.
He'd have said, I told you that almost 100 years ago, most class-ridden society in the world. maybe forever. You know, your election and ours makes me wonder why we are not more effective at the sort of anti-Twitter end, talking about things that really are not disputed. Pikettyism, for example, the fact that people with capital, with assets, are getting richer, and they vote with Boris Johnson and Trump, and the workers are getting screwed. Seriously, why can't we have a sort of sober, and not particularly finger-pointing, but clarifying conversation around that point?
So I think for your country and my country, part of the challenge is we're having to have that conversation in a political system where we have the same two parties we've had for 100 years. You've had this. I know the parties change, and particularly Republicans and Democrats have been through different configurations, but they got the same names, and certainly for the last 50 years, they represent the dividing line in our political life, and it doesn't fit anymore. So if you want to talk about the working classes being screwed, you just cannot assume anymore that the appropriate political vehicle for that is inevitably the Labour Party or inevitably the Democratic Party. You have to understand that a skillful politician, and Trump has skills, some, Johnson certainly has skills, can communicate in a way that conveys that message and then cuts right across traditional allegiances. And we are trapped by the fact, I think, we have to channel all of these things through this very binary politics where you've got to pick sides between these two parties, and the central issues cut across the two parties. So Brexit, for us, that was the other revelation. Brexit divided our nation down the middle, and it divided the two parties down the middle. And you know, our politics is so tribal, you have to take your stand, defend your party, defend your tribe. And yet, you know, this is what Labour people have discovered in this election. People who passionately care about what you've just been talking about, growing inequality, the way in which ordinary people are being screwed, they took their side, they defended their tribe, and they discovered that for the people that they were defending, that's no longer the tribe, because they are seeing it very differently. They're seeing the tribalism differently. And we're all struggling with that. It's just not simple, I think. It's just not simple to know how to keep it simple.
But is that tribal habit the same thing that's blocking the conversation we have to have around climate?
Yeah, I think it is. And that's the other fact about this election, that the Labour Party went into it with a Green New Deal agenda and they lost. And that may be a lesson for Democrats as well. It's a, you know, that really ambitious transformational politics, which is very appealing to a younger generation, is alienating for an older generation, not because they don't care about climate change, not because they don't care about the future, but because they are extremely reluctant to embrace what looks to them like very rapid radical change. And no one's going to win without some of those people. I mean, if I was a Democrat, I would be thinking really hard, regardless of the candidates, about how you build a coalition that, not just the Obama coalition or whatever, but how you build a coalition that, that transcends generational divisions. And climate makes that really hard, I'm afraid. It makes it really hard.
One more parallelism between your country and ours, and that's these shadowy, dark, almost demonic figures of Nigel Farage on your side and Steve Bannon on ours. What do the English make of this kind of Rasputin, weird, intellectual adventurer, Nigel Farage?
So again, I don't think Farage is Bannon. So Farage has stood for election and lost. I mean, he's the opposite of Boris Johnson. He's lost seven times in a row, didn't even try this time. But he does at least occasionally put his head above the parapet. He made a shrewd political judgment in this election, which is he withdrew his party from seats where the Conservatives were standing. He was pretty pragmatic in the end, and he got what he wanted, which is Brexit. I believe he's now moving over to the United States to work for the Trump campaign, so we'll get more of him than we will. But he's also a one-issue candidate, so he's not really a kind of civilizational, whatever Bannon is, that kind of, you know, everything connects and it's a fight between good and evil. Farage always was about delivering Britain's exit from the European Union. And whatever you think of him, I think people, historians, will look back on this period of British politics and say that Nigel Farage was both an important politician and also he was a winner. I mean, he's lost every election he fought, but he won the vote that mattered. So he's both a narrower figure than Bannon. He's more pragmatic. He's also possibly going to have a longer-lasting effect on the politics of this country.
David Runciman, it's a pleasure talking politics with you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
There's a lot more of David Runciman and company at Talking Politics Podcast.
opensource.com. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of smart, energetic, independent podcasts. This week, we want to give a shout out to our friend Tamar Abishai, who hosts the art history podcast called The Lonely Palette, and who's just moving from Boston to Cleveland. Happy trails, Tamar. Go to thelonelypalette.com to hear Tamar's latest episode about the Dutch master Jan van Eyck, and check out all of the Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, the artist Susan Coyne, and the engineer George Hicks. We had help from Mark Rendiro, Catherine Carr, and Rosie Gillies. Mary McGrath is our precinct chairman. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.